would be nice to see some great projects from this class. And apologies. I don't know if anybody is really sorry, but this class is only going to go till about 8:40. And it's my stupidity about scheduling. I have something in Toronto, a talk tomorrow in philosophy in Toronto. And again, I forgot that Thursday comes right after Wednesday night. So my apologies. But again, I don't know if anybody's really sorry, but let me know if you are. While we're talking about scheduling, there is a phenomenon. For those of you who are not taking, who are not students, you won't know that there is a phenomenon called Reading Week. And Reading Week is the week that includes February 20th. Is that correct? Okay. And so, so first of all, is that the same as Reading Week at Western? No. Okay. When is your reading week?
It's the following week.
I see. So let's take this one at a time. And Guelph again. We don't see you, Guelph. But if you're there, when is your reading week?
February 20th.
So the same. So, if we were reasonable people, we would not have the class on February 20th. Let me do this. If there are people who will not be here on February 20th, can you raise your hands now? One. Anybody over there? Okay. Right. So what about the 25th? Will everybody be here the 25th or able to? I don't see any hands over there. Okay, so we will lose one person each on the 20th and the 25th. So my proposal is to keep going and go right through Reading Week. And if somebody is unhappy with that, please communicate with me offline. Okay? Otherwise, we'll go through Reading Week. The classes, as everybody knows, are available electronically. Okay. Very good. So any questions, comments up till now? Okay. What I want to do today is we're continuing our discussion of constrained systems. And we're actually pretty close to the schedule. I just have to find it. And what we're going to do this time is first something that was not on the schedule but is easy to do, which is adding mass to Maxwell theory. And this is just a good lesson to see what the cost of breaking gauge invariance is. So we'll do that. And then we'll talk about the F theory and do both the Lagrangian and the Hamiltonian version. And this will be our first diffeomorphism invariant theory. It has some added features as well. It's what's called a topological field theory. And I think that will probably take us through today. And then next time, we will do GR, general relativity, in a form closely related to BF theory called the Plobansky form, which is related to the Ashtakar variables and so forth. Okay, so that's where we're going. Okay, so I'm just going to write down some of the formulas from electromagnetism and add a mass term, and then we'll discuss the consequence. So the action as before is minus 1/4. Actually, I'm going to take that out already. Let me put, so the integral d4x minus 1/4 f mu nu, and we're going to add a term m squared over 2 a mu a nu eta mu nu. And we'll come back and worry about what's the right sign. So this is the analog of a mass term. If it were scalar field theory, then the action would be integral g mu nu del nu phi minus m squared over 2 phi squared, determinant of square root of g. And the equations of motion would be box minus m squared phi equals 0. And that's what we mean by a mass in field theory. So, and indeed, here the equations of motion include, we didn't write them actually before, but let's write them now, del mu f mu nu, which is normally 0, and now it's minus m squared a upper index nu equals 0. And if we write out what this is, remembering what f mu nu is, this is box a nu minus del nu del mu a mu minus m squared, lowering the index there, equals 0. And so, as often people do in Lagrangian field theory, if you fix the gauge like this, this is called Lorentz gauge. And this reduces the ability to make a gauge transformation, so it can be called a partial gauge fixing. And if one does that, then one has box minus m squared a nu. So each component of the four components of A behaves as if it has a mass. So that's why it's natural to call that a mass term. Yes? Yes, we're coming to that. Thank you. Thank you. And in fact, that's the point. The gauge transformations are delta A mu is derivative of mu, the gradient of a function. And under these, the variation of the action is no longer 0. It's square root of g mu nu a mu. It's proportional to m squared a mu del nu, the derivative of a function. And if there's 2, which cancels another 2. So, so there's an issue. It appears that we've broken gauge invariance. Okay, and let's see what we've been doing the last 2 lectures is discussing how to understand gauge invariance at the Hamiltonian level. So let's see what the effect of that is. So I'll assume we go through the same steps as before. So making the canonical momenta pi. So pi 0, which is delta s, delta a dot 0, is still 0. Pi spatial index a, delta s, delta a dot a, is still what it was before. G a nu, if we write down everything, g f 0 nu. So that's, and don't trust me on signs. The signs we had before, if these differ, are better. But the point is the canonical momenta don't change. We still have, therefore, a primary constraint, pi 0 equals 0. is a primary constraint. So we're going to worry about keeping that. The Hamiltonian is still integral pi a, a dot a plus pi 0, a dot 0 minus the Lagrangian. And that still is the integral of a half pi a squared, a half fab squared. And there's still a term proportional to a 0. And the term proportional to a 0 is now del a pi a plus m squared over 2 a 0, because minus the Lagrangian, there is minus this term. And that's the only change in the construction of the Hamiltonian, is that there is this term here. Okay? Is everybody with me? These are all steps that we've gone through before. And we now ask about preserving pi 0. That's the Poisson bracket of pi 0 with the Hamiltonian. I should add plus some Lagrange multiplier times pi 0 there, since that's a constraint. And what comes out is the derivative of this initial Hamiltonian by a 0. So that ends up being del a pi a minus, there's a factor of 2, so just m squared a 0. So one gets an additional constraint, as before. And there's this new term, m squared a 0. Okay. And let's call this guy, as before, G for Gauss's law. And that has to be a new constraint, which we set equal to 0. Otherwise, pi 0 is not preserved. So far, this is the same logic as with electromagnetism without the mass term. And so the Hamiltonian now should be the integral, and again, I'm skipping in essential things, pi squared plus a half ab squared plus some Lagrange multiplier times pi 0. And now we have a Lagrange multiplier, another Lagrange multiplier, I'll call it mu, times g. By Dirac's argument that we always add Lagrange multipliers to the Hamiltonian, so that the variational principle in Hamiltonian language is the same as the variational principle otherwise. Okay. So now, can anybody see what's different? So the next step is we're supposed to check whether G is preserved under evolution, whether this constraint is preserved. And we already know that G commutes with this and this. The only new thing that's added to G that wasn't there before is A0. The only new thing that can happen, G commutes with itself, is if the A0 hits the pi here. But it does. So there's a term which looks like it's proportional to lambda. So this is, if we're going to get precise, G at a point y. And we have here the integral d3x, lambda at a point x. minus m squared, and now we have the Poisson bracket of a zero at the point y with pi zero at the point x, which wasn't there before. This is delta three y x. Again, if you're keeping track, it's a density on the x. So one integrates over x and one gets minus m squared lambda at x. Y, sorry, thank you. Yes.
Involving n naught squared. Your constraints.
I skipped a step, so. Well, actually, you know what? You're right, and I'm wrong. You're right, and I'm wrong, because let's go back over that. Thank you very much. So I added this, but I still have this. So I have, because of this factor of two, so let's break that down. So that's another a0 times g, but a0 times g is minus a whole, so there's a plus a0 squared m squared. Okay, very good. Let me come back and worry about that in a second and make the statement here. Okay. So what's happening is that to preserve G, we get something in the Lagrange multiplier. Okay, the Lagrange multiplier, which multiplies, it's this Lagrange multiplier here. So how are we going to solve that? And what's, you know, what's going on here? Okay. Lambda is arbitrary. If m squared is zero, we're back to what we had before. G is preserved. Okay. Lambda is arbitrary, and so we have an issue here. Right? It looks like we're not preserving. Okay. So if we think about what's going on here is that the algebra of constraints is now no longer closing. And in particular, a way to say that is that the algebra of the constraints G and pi, so g of y, pi of z, is picking out exactly this term. There's a term which is m squared, the commutator, I'm sorry, this is pi zero, of z with a zero of x, so it's delta three y of z. So the algebra is not closing. And we say that the algebra here is second class, if you remember my characterizations of the algebra. Okay. Now, how do we proceed? I'm not going to go any further right now because I just want to leave this as a caution, and we'll come back later and talk about how we proceed when we get in steps like this. But I want to wait till we're discussing the quantum mechanics. Clearly, we're not going to succeed just by following the Dirac procedure as it was. We're going to have to, and what we're going to have to do to anticipate, but I don't want to go through the formalism of it now, is we're going to have to change the notion of the time derivatives so that g and pi can be preserved. And what that's going to involve is changing the definition of the Poisson brackets. Essentially, what we're going to have to do is change the definition of the Poisson brackets to force the Poisson bracket of two functions on the constraint surface to be just in the constraint surface. The Poisson bracket is like a derivative. And what we're going to have to do is project the Poisson brackets by hand into the constraint surface to get them to close, or to get them, sorry, not to close, to be preserved. And there's a way to do that called Dirac brackets. And I don't want to go further with that now, but I wanted to introduce the issue. So one doesn't get a gauge invariance. That is, one doesn't get here. One can't just proceed and go forward and impose the constraints with free Lagrange multipliers. A consequence of what I just said is that the Lagrange multipliers will also get determined as functions of other variables. But if you don't mind, I just wanted to go this far. So keep this in your notes, and let's go on. But are there any questions? Yes.
What happens if you have a scalar field with
the
iterate, what
you said
last year?
You mean if I do it, if I make a Higgs theory?
Yeah. Then you put the minimal magnification there.
Sure. I mean, there is, of course, a way to give mass to vector bosons through the Higgs effect or the Stueckelberg formalism. And I'm not teaching this because I want to go in that direction, so I'm not going to go in that direction. Okay? What I wanted to indicate is how breaking gauge invariance results in the analysis that Dirac gave breaking down. And the analysis that Dirac gave us a Hamiltonian with free Lagrange multipliers multiplying constraints, which corresponded to the gauge freedom. The freedom of the Lagrange multipliers corresponded to the gauge freedom, and we no longer are in that situation. So that's the point that I hope is clear. Yes.
Even in the previous situation and get an Hamiltonian without?
No, because the Dirac brackets will involve inverting the lack of closure of G. Yes.
So you cannot always project by fiat?
No. You can only do that when the constraints, conveniently, you can only do that when the constraints don't close. Okay. If somebody wants an exercise, if you're bored for the next hour, then you can just clunk ahead with that and see how you fix it in that case. Okay, now we discussed last time SU2 Yang-Mills theory. So I'm going to start off in a similar setting. I'm going to have a gauge field valued in SU2. So to just revive the notation, it's A mu I, tau I, where those are the Pauli matrices. And these also can be considered 2x2 matrices. And if we need those indices, which we won't, they're capital A and B. There is the field strength, F mu nu I, del mu A nu I, minus del mu A mu I, plus epsilon I j k, A mu j A mu k. There is, and so forth. But now let me ask the question, an interesting question. Supposing we have some four-dimensional manifold. So M, some four-dimensional manifold. And for the moment, I'm going to make it compact so we don't have to worry about boundary conditions. We will eventually come back and worry about boundary conditions. But in the cosmological case, which will be interested when we're talking about the issue of the nature of time, of course, there's no asymptotic regions or boundaries. Okay. And let me ask, supposing we don't have a metric. So I don't let you anywhere write down a metric. Can I have dynamics for a gauge field in four dimensions without a metric? What can I do? Right. Well, roughly speaking, there are two things. There are three things you can do. One of them is general relativity, which we'll come to. And the others are interesting classes of theories, which are called topological field theories. And all these theories are diffeomorphism invariant, as we'll see explicitly. One thing you can do is you can write an action, which is the integral over the manifold. So I'll use both form and tensor notation, but this is a two form. So if you know the notation, I can write F wedge F, sum over the gauge internal indices. And I can take this action. Okay. And I'm not going to further analyze that, but that will become an exercise. This, it's not difficult to argue, but I'm not going to argue it now because given what we're going to develop, this will be an exercise, has no local degrees of freedom and just measures topology. And it measures topology in a particular sense in which the quantum theory associated with it is a tool which allows you to measure properties of this four-dimensional manifold. Okay. So that's one thing you can do, and it involves no additional fields. And that's the only thing you can do that involves no additional fields. Now, there's a slightly more intricate thing you can do, which is introduce another two-form field, B mu nu I, which is also a two-form valued in SU2. So you can think of it as living in the Hermitian 2x2 matrices, or you can think of it as a triplet of two forms. And you can write B wedge F, which in terms of indices, the wedge is given by the totally antisymmetric tensor epsilon, and it's B mu nu I F alpha beta I. You can do that. And that turns out to be a very interesting thing to do, and we'll be developing it. There's a little bit more you can do, which is you can add, we had before the term which was square in F wedge F, you can also add a term in B wedge B. And I'm going to put a parameter in it to distinguish those two terms and call it lambda over 2. So this is minus lambda over 2 B mu nu I B alpha beta I. Okay, and those are a class of theories called BF theory. And they were first studied, to my knowledge, by Gary Horowitz and Vikar Hussain independently. And they're wonderful little gizmos, as we'll be finding out. Okay? So any question about the notation? Because that's what we're going to study. Well, first, let's look at the Lagrangian theory. So, first of all, notice that this is a well-defined object. This is a four-form, and you can integrate a four-form in four dimensions. Equivalently, this epsilon is a density. And so written out in some coordinate system where these are the indices, this is a density. And so it's integrable. So it's an object that makes sense. It doesn't rely on a set of coordinates or a reference frame. So it's coordinate independent. And as we'll be seeing, it's diffeomorphism invariant. So it's well defined. Let's look at the equations of motion then. So if I vary the action by first B mu nu I. I asked once before, is there a preference for form notation or index notation? One for form notation out there, you guys? Out there in Western? Are they there, form notation or index notation? Okay. Doesn't matter. Okay. Okay. So I will write the first few equations both ways, and then I'll drop forms. But if there's any ambiguity, please ask. Okay. So I have F alpha beta I minus lambda, the factor of 2 goes away, B alpha beta I equals 0. And in form notation, that's just F equals lambda B, like that. So the field B just tells me what the curvature tensor should be. And then delta S, delta the connection, A mu gives me, I integrate by parts, and it gives me, I'll write it first in form notation and then in index notation, dB equals 0. Okay, because if I vary delta S is the integral of B wedge delta of F, and delta of F is the covariant derivative of delta of A. And these are things which, if you haven't gone through them, please go through the steps. This formula that I've just written takes a few steps to discover. You remember from last time the meaning of the covariant derivative. So in terms of indices, again, this is integral epsilon mu nu alpha beta B mu nu I covariant derivative alpha of the variation of the gauge field A beta. And the whole thing has an index I like that. One can then, if there's no boundary, one can integrate by parts. And if you've never done this before, please check and convince yourself that covariant derivatives can be integrated by parts. And when you integrate by parts, you put the derivative on the B, and that's what multiplies the variation of A. And the equation of motion is covariant derivative of B equals 0. And again, in index notation, it's now del alpha B mu nu a free index for the gauge field I and a free index for the beta equals 0. Yeah.
Clarify, when you say covariant derivative, you mean the covariant derivative of the gauge connection?
Oh, thank you very much. I mean covariant derivative of the gauge connection. There's no metric. There's no Christoffel symbol. Okay. There's no nothing but what's explicitly on the board. Okay. And I will never in this class hide stuff inside a covariant derivative which depends on the metric in some implicit way. Okay. I mean just the same gauge Yang-Mills covariant derivative that we discussed last time. Okay, was that your question?
Well, kind of. I mean, it's closed anyway because it's exact. So then the second equation cannot should simplify
the
first equation.
Well, yes, and so thank you. So let's notice. Let's notice that on solutions of the first equation, okay, I can plug the first equation into the second equation, and that's 1 over lambda d covariant derivative of f equals 0, and that's the Bianchi identities. That's true identically. And that's very good. If that didn't happen, we would have an additional equation of motion. If this was not true identically. Okay? So there's a tightness of fit between these two equations.
Sure, I can try.
It's a little flatter or something.
I'll
go the other way. Flatter.
Why do you just not write way
chat? I
agree that everything's right.
Okay.
Not writing wedges is a step that the physicists will not take, even the more mathematical physicists.
Okay.
I'll put feet on the lambdas. Thank you. Okay. Okay. Now, what are the invariances, the gauge symmetries of this theory? So first, there is local, so what are the gauge symmetries? And I'm going to leave some of these as exercises to check. One is ordinary Yang-Mills symmetry. So remember, ordinary Yang-Mills symmetry is covariant derivative goes to some U inverse covariant derivative U. That, or infinitesimally, delta A mu I is covariant derivative of a triplet of functions, Fi, and I'll write that out once we had it last time, Fi plus epsilon ij k A mu j fk. But, of course, we have to transform the B's as well. And the B's are like a vector in the three SU2 indices, or they're really a matrix. And so the B's transform homogeneously, that is just by U inverse BU, or delta B is just the homogeneous term, epsilon IJK, FJ BK, and which is, in other words, how F transforms. And so you can check that both this term and this term are invariant under ordinary gauge transformations. Both the B and the F transform homogeneously. They're like vectors in the three-dimensional space of SU2 generators. But then there is also diffeomorphisms. And you can just observe that the action is the difference between two 4-forms. And those are well-defined objects, so they are diffeomorphism invariant. But you can also write down the infinitesimal. So if I have a diffeomorphism on the manifold M generated by some vector field V alpha, then the variation of all the geometrical objects, but let's start with A, is by the Lie derivative of A with respect to the vector field, and the same thing with the 2-form. And indeed, for any field, we would write down. Where these are the Lie derivatives. And let me leave it as an exercise to check that. And also, if you haven't done differential geometry in a little while, and you want to remember what the Lie derivative is, and remember how to compute with it, this is a good exercise. So the exercise is delta S equals 0. So these are invariances. OK, any questions? OK, let's see what happens at the Hamiltonian level, because our whole interest is in getting practice at understanding how to represent these theories in Hamiltonian language, because we want to study their quantum mechanics, and we need the precise Hamiltonian language first. Okay, so let me come back to here. And let's do, and I hope this is not boring, but I also kind of hope it is, because everything we did before with the scalar field theory, with Maxwell, with the Yang-Mills, was warm up for this. So now what we're going to do is we're going to assume that our four-dimensional space-time is a three-manifold cross R. So it's non-compact in one direction. And so it's no longer completely compact. Sigma, the three-manifold, will continue to be compact. We're going to assume the existence of a slicing that lets us have a preferred time coordinate. So the coordinates x mu are a preferred time coordinate, and the three spatial coordinates xa. So we give a arbitrary slicing, and there's no metric or anything to define the slicing with respect to. We just make an arbitrary slicing according to values of this arbitrary coordinate, which coordinatizes this R. So this is t equals 1, t equals 2, t equals 3, et cetera. And then that lets us decompose the forms. So A mu, say I. And if you want to say this in a fancy way, you have an embedding of each slice into the, which is a three-dimensional manifold, into the four manifold. And forms pull back. So there's a mapping of a slice. That's, say, the t equals 4 slice. And given such a mapping, forms pull back. And the pullback is called AAA. And that which is left over is A0, which is a function in terms of the differential geometry of the 3 slice. So the one forms decompose into a one form on each slice and a function, and the two forms degenerate to B0A. Sorry, can I write down here? Sure. Okay, so the two forms go to this one with the zero component here, B0A. So that's a one form on each three slice, and then a two form on each three slice. And those are defined just by the embedding of each three slice, that is just by specifying the preferred time chord. So I want to emphasize this because this is geometrical, and these objects A0, AA, B0A, BAB are then forms of the appropriate degree on each of these three slices. And then that's what happens to the action is not too complicated. But if we look at that form, the epsilon mu nu alpha beta, one of those is A0. So one gets a term like B0A wedge FBC, and there's an overall here epsilon ABC, and then I don't need to write the wedge, I, and there are, if we're keeping track, there are two of those because there's two ways to put the 0A here. And there's also, I can do it the other way and have a BBC, F0A, and there's two of those. And then the same thing with the B wedge B term, but there's four of those. And this is times lambda over 2. Okay. So now this is in the form where we see explicitly where the time derivatives are. There's only one place where there's any time derivatives, and that's as before in Yang-Mills theory inside of here. Inside of here, there's a del 0 as before, A minus covariant derivative A of A0. And therefore, as before, pi 0 I is 0 because there's A0 has no time derivatives. But notice that no B has any time derivatives either. And let me, there's always an interesting issue about what notation you use for that. Okay. So let's call P mu nu I the conjugate momenta for B, and these are all 0 as well because the B's have no time derivatives whatsoever. And then the only place, so these are all primary constraints. And the only place there's a regular ordinary canonical momenta is the spatial pi AIs. And you can see that they're just proportional to the spatial Bs. These are epsilon ABC B, B, C, I. And what's different from electromagnetism, remember in electromagnetism, the electric fields, which are the momenta for the vector potential, had a dodonym. They were proportional to F0A. Here it's proportional to B, and B has no time derivatives in them. So these are also constraints. And now I have to give a bunch of things names. So we have I'm going to call these constraints pi and b and p just for ease of language. And now I'm going to have some constraints that I'm going to call e ai, which is pi ai minus epsilon abc bdci equals 0. Okay, any questions? So we have lots of constraints. The reason we have lots of constraints is that this theory has very few degrees of freedom, as we'll develop. Okay, any questions? Let me just look.
Why do you not put a metric in this search? Truly, the manifold has a shape, so it has a metric. Why do you not want to put it in?
Thank you. Well, let's deal with this right at the beginning. No.
Truly, the manifold does not have a shape. It doesn't. So mathematics, okay, so in the construction of general relativity, mathematics has the following steps. When you construct a space-time in general relativity, there is the manifold, which is a collection of points. Okay. There are the, and I'm not going to say this in the best way, but I'll get the point across. This is just a big collection of points. Then you put on a structure where you give open sets of the manifold. So here's the manifold, and you give open sets, and you give maps from open sets. There's a little piece of Rn to open sets in Rn. Okay? And then you give, then you require that these be smooth. Now, what does smooth mean? Smoothness is something which is defined in Rn. What that means is that if there's another set which overlaps that, which goes somewhere else in Rn, then by going from here to this region, the overlap to here, you get a map from a piece of Rn to a piece of Rn, and you require that for every such overlap, these maps are C infinite, which is defined in Rn. Okay? And that's the structure of a differential manifold. So that's the level in which you say there's a differential manifold. The such objects have some properties, like they have dimension, they have topology. Topology are properties of the open sets. Okay, so one can construct and compute some topological invariance just from these data that goes into these maps. So you can make sense, are they open or closed, are they compact, are they non-compact, and much more. And they have diffeomorphisms defined on them, which are actually a group. So there's the group diffeomorphisms of the manifold. Okay. So far there's no metric, no fields. Okay. That's a raw differential manifold. Okay. Then general relativity tells us on top of that to introduce a metric. And then in addition to that, introduce some other fields, like A, Yang-Mills field, scalar fields, spinner fields, et cetera. Okay? And then you get the differential manifold with a metric, with fields, and that's what general relativity studied. But the metric is just one kind of field that can be put on a manifold, so there's nothing that prevents you from skipping that step and defining a well-defined mathematical field theory without that. And that's what we're doing. And all the cautionary things I said in the first classes about always being explicit about raising and lowering indices, always put, which I have not, wasn't in the first part consistent about, but one should be always consistent about density weights and so forth, always consistent about the difference between form fields and vector fields, is because it becomes essential to keep track of those things when there's no fixed metric. Now, so I can't resist a philosophical comment. A philosophical comment is, why in the world, why is the world, why should we believe the world is made that way? That's pretty complicated. You know, with all those separate steps which may or may not be there, they're only weakly linked with each other. Maybe fundamentally, since we want to merge this with quantum theory, and quantum theory is very algebraic. Quantum theory has a lot of discreteness in it. Maybe those are two clues about how we want to merge this with quantum theory. And the other thing is that in general relativity, the metric, in fact, is just another field. It's as dynamical as any other field. So we don't want to, especially, again, if we're thinking of general relativity as a dynamical system, we're thinking of it as a system we're going to treat quantum mechanically, we don't want to treat it any differently than any of the other fields. And a last comment is that where we're going is reformulating general relativity so that the metric is actually emergent. That is what we'll see in the next class, is that something very close to this BF theory is general relativity, and the metric is not in the Lagrangian, it's not in the field equations, it emerges as the parameterization of the solutions of the field equations. And that seems to be a more powerful point of view from the point of view of the quantum theory. Okay, so good. I'm glad you asked that. So is that clear? Okay. And a final point is that the theories like this have been developed primarily by mathematicians. I mean, I think they were written down by physicists first, but they've really, the details and especially the quantum theories have been developed by mathematics because they are the most powerful tools for studying the topology of 3- and 4-dimensional manifolds where the metric isn't relevant. Okay. I'm going to get to these. Okay, so now there's a little bit of some painful steps, which is we have to follow Mr. Dirac's algorithm. And so we have to write the Hamiltonian. The Hamiltonian is the integral on the 3-manifold of the PQ dot, so pi AI A dot AI. And again, for the same reason, you know, the pi's are all densities, so this makes sense without a metric. And I promised that I would often, but I've dropped off notating the densities by twiddles. So these are all twiddles. So these are all densities. Pi A dot plus pi zero A dot zero I. Please don't be too bored while we do this. P mu nu I B dot mu nu I minus Lagrangian, and let's just look at what the Lagrangian is here. So the Lagrangian already has minus B A dot, so what there actually already is right here a minus epsilon ABC BBCI A dot AI. And I'll combine that in a minute. So that's this term. Then there's this times B. And I'm not keeping track of numerical factors for the moment. So there is a term which is epsilon ABC, same guy, BCI, times covariant derivative of A0i. So now we've taken care of this term. Then we have just these two terms, which are, I'll put over here, minus B0a epsilon ABCi. And now we have FBCi minus BBCi lambda. Lambda over 2. Okay? So now I've written down this term, and absorbed their common factor B. If you will let me, I'd like to absorb these two things proportional to A dot. So if this is not too confusing, there is pi AI minus B minus epsilon ABC BBC I times A dot AI. Okay? And somebody please look carefully and convince yourself that I didn't forget anything. Oh, I did forget something. So what I forgot is that we're supposed to add the constraints. So let's just do that, plus some lambda I pi 0 I plus something I'll call omega mu I p mu I, and another object rho AI EAI. Okay, so that's the whole Hamiltonian. And it looks like a mess, but it's about to get much simpler. Okay. So, question? Yeah.
So is this supposed to be something different to the original F squared theory that you wrote down, the Chern test that you wrote down?
Yes, this is different. Yes, so aside to topologists, this computes the signature rather than the Chern class.
Naively, I would have said that you could just integrate out B.
Yes. Yes, you could say that.
So something's wrong with saying.
Something, yeah. And which has to do with what the notion of the measure and integrating out and so forth. Okay. And I apologize that
we're slugging through this, but this is going to save us steps next time when we slug through general relativity, which is going to be this plus only one more term. Okay. So the first thing that we want to do, as before, is preserve the constraint pi 0. And pi 0 is going to act exactly in the same way. There is stuff proportional to A0, which we integrate by parts. And so pi 0 dot is going to imply a constraint, and we'll call it G, which is del A. Let me put the epsilon outside. Epsilon ABC del A BBC. I is equal to 0. So there's something that looks a lot like Gauss's law. Okay. And in fact, notice that we have another constraint that says that epsilon B is pi. Okay. So this is tending to look like D pi equals 0. Now, let me remember the logic here. Let's consider the part inside here, which is just the spatial part. Okay, I want to just separate things out. So there's a part here which is, well, if you remember the Dirac analysis, I'm looking for the simplest way to say this. If you remember the Dirac analysis, the whole issue now is which constraints form classes which close and which constraints form algebras which don't close. Okay. So let me, without going through all the messy details, just make some observations. Let's look at the spatial part of this. Okay, so let's look at what that says is that pi bci, well, I'm calling them p, at some point x is equal to 0. So we have 3 times 3 such constraints, 3 for the gauge index and 3 for this anti-symmetric index for every point of space. But notice we have these 3 times 3 constraints also for every point of space. Okay? And these don't commute with these. It's easy. Let's look at that. Let's look at E A I of X with P B C Y of J. And look, the only thing that's going to happen is that this B here meets its canonical momenta here. So this is going to be delta 3 xy times epsilon abc, picking up the epsilon abc in here, times delta ij, because that only happens when the I and the J are equal to each other. So these P's, the 9 of those at every point, and the 9 E's are all second class. Okay, so what is one going to do? Dirac says that's a problem. These do not generate a closed algebra. They don't generate gauge transformations. So what should we do with them? Well, one of the things that I argued last time or the time before we could do is we can set canonical variables into pairs and eliminate second class constraints. So look what I can do. I can just everywhere get rid of the B's, the spatial parts of the B's, by replacing them by the pi's. These are the momenta for the gauge field. And if everywhere I use this constraint and replace the B's by the momenta for the gauge fields, and at the same time I eliminate the momenta for the B's that I just eliminated, I just reduce the theory, and I do it consistently because I get rid of canonical pairs. So that's what we're going to do. We're going to eliminate those constraints everywhere, and then the result is that G is d pi, which is what Gauss's law was for electromagnetism. We've eliminated E so we can forget it, and we have in that case, and we've eliminated this so we can forget it. So we don't have much left. In fact, the Hamiltonian is, if you look at it, just A0 times G, plus we have still the terms in lambda pi 0, and we have some terms in the B's that are left over, so P0A, B0A dot II And I think that's about it. And all that the theory now depends on is the canonical pairs AA and its canonical momenta. And we have a few, we have still A0 and pi0. We're about to get rid of those. And then we have this pair P0A, B0A. But unless I'm missing something, that doesn't come in anywhere because that's this minus, that already multiplied FBC minus B. Oh, sorry. There is one more thing. There is B0A, epsilon ABC, FBC minus lambda over 2, DBCI. So that's what there is. And there is the constraint, some lambda prime A P zero A I. Okay, so we're almost done. Anything I left out? What it means is that in the constraint surface and the solutions of the constraints, we can eliminate a conjugate pair. So there's some Q number 117, and its conjugate P number 117. Okay? And they have non-vanishing Poisson brackets. But nothing else depends on them. So we can set Q 117 equals 0 and P 117 equals 0, and no equation of motion is affected because they don't come in anywhere else. Yeah.
Again, maybe I'm wrong, but it looks like the reason that's working is because B is auxiliary in the original.
Of course, yes. So you want to come back to your question of why is this not the Turing test? I don't know that I'm going to be able to answer you in a simple way.
Perhaps it's even complicated.
Yes, I know. I have seen the calculations for the topological invariants gotten by the corresponding quantum theory, and they compute different topological invariants. But I don't think I could show that to you in the half an hour that I have. I can study and try to show that to you in a week. Okay. And I don't have an answer to your puzzle.
Crane Yetter.
The quantum theory is called the Crane Yetter model.
Late '80s, early '90s. Okay. So now I notice that there's now the same argument with respect to A0 and pi0. A0 is playing a role just as a Lagrange multiplier. Pi0 is nowhere else. A0 is nowhere else. So I can cancel these. I have to still have a term proportional to the constraint. But this is now just some arbitrary Lagrange multiplier. Okay. I then have exactly the same structure here with the B0 space and its conjugate momenta P0 space. Nothing else depends on the P. And the B is the Lagrange multiplier. If I make the same kind of argument I did before, it goes like this. I want to preserve the P0A. Preserving the P0A, going P0A dot equals 0 and imposing that, is going to spit out a new constraint. And let me give this a name. Let me call this script F AB gauge index I FABI minus lambda. And this No, this should not. I was cavalier about the factors of 2 before, but there's not a factor of 2 there. BABI equals 0. But recall that these we've already gotten rid of. These are pi's. So this is epsilon ABC pi CI equals 0. And I get these new constraints. Therefore, and then I can drop that P0A just like I dropped the pi zeros. And in the end, I have a theory which just has the A's and the pi's in it for the spatial parts. I have two constraints, GI, which is the covariant divergence of pi AI equals 0, and these constraints called FABI that I just wrote down, FABI minus lambda epsilon ABC pi CI equals 0. So I have 3 times 3 is 6, I'm sorry, is 9, plus 3 is 12 constraints per point. And the Hamiltonian that I'm left with is just some Lagrange multiplier times GI plus some other Lagrange multiplier times F. This Lagrange multiplier has to have more indices. How do I want to do it? I'll do it like that. Okay? So, does everybody have, if you didn't follow every step, where we are? Okay? Now, last thing we have to do is check the algebra of these remaining constraints. So we remember the algebra of G's with G's, because this is just the same as we had before with Yang-Mills theory. So GI of X, GJ of Y, taking it from last time, is epsilon IJK, GK of Y, delta 3, XY. So that is a first class algebra among the G's. And that, as before, generates local gauge transformations. So we wrote down before that the effect of varying with G, what G does is it gives delta A, goes like the covariant gradient of a function, and delta pi goes like epsilon ijk goes homogeneously or linearly, it said, in the momenta. So we had that before. Then we have to do the Fs with the Fs and the Gs with the Fs. The Gs with the Fs at X and at Y. And to compute these things, you should use the technique that I told you about last time of integrating first over a function and taking Poisson brackets of integrals weighed with functions. But when you do that, I'll leave it as an exercise to extract the answer. When you do that, the Fs, look, we can talk it through. The Fs are the field strengths, which under gauge transformations transform homogeneously. They just rotate. And the pi's, which I just told you, rotate. They're the canonical momenta. So the F's will just rotate. So this has to look like epsilon ijk, fk, ab, at, say, y, delta 3, xy. And that leaves the Fs with the Fs. Any guesses? It's non-trivial because the Fs have the canonical momentum, the pi's, and they also have the a's, the vector potentials in here. So you actually have to do a calculation. Okay? And I'll leave that also as an exercise, that the Fs with the Fs, Poisson brackets, and you know what I'm going to write if I don't write any indices, they all vanish. And that's a calculation. And I hope I did it right, but I've done it bunches of times before. Okay, so this is a homework check. And this is a homework check. And now let's look at what we got. And so first, the Hamiltonian is zero on the constraint surface. The Hamiltonian is weakly zero. The energy of every constraint, of every configuration that satisfies the constraints is zero. Okay, so that's the first thing that we have. The second thing is, let's look at what this algebra, let me just give you an evocative way to see the algebra. It's as if at each point in space, there's an SU2, a local rotation group. That's what the gauge transformations are. And then there's the Fs. And the Fs commute with each other. And they rotate like a vector under these rotations. So they're like translations. So it's as if you have three translations that commute with each other at each point, and then a group of rotations that rotate them amongst themselves. So it looks like you have the 3D Euclidean group. That's the name for the rotations plus the translations, times, you know, infinity to the third power. One of those But it's actually even more than that. I forgot to, okay, so I just mistook myself. It's that for each AB, because there's three of these and three of these, but I forgot there's three of these. Okay, so sorry, for a moment I was in 2+1 dimensions. It's not like a 3D Euclidean group, it's like you have three translations plus rotations at each point. So it's even worse than that. Okay, so apologies, I jumped to 2+1. Okay. And now let's count. Okay. Per point, there are 9 A's. And there are 9 momenta conjugate to them. Okay. So there are 18 degrees of freedom per point, 9 coordinates and 9 momenta. Okay. But there are 3 times 3. Plus 3. So these are the degrees of freedom. In the degrees of freedom of the gauge transformations, there are 12 per point. Okay? So there are, okay, and if these are all first class, you're going to get 12 gauge fixing conditions So there are 24 constraints per point. So what did I do wrong? Did I count wrong? 3 times 3 is 9, plus 3 is 12. I did something wrong. What did I do wrong? I did make a mistake. Anybody see it? Okay. One more minute.
To specify a gauge transformation, you just have to give me one function, one SMT value function.
No, because now I can generate gauge transformations by these.
Okay, so I somehow got lost in the details of this.
Well, these are first-class constraints. The Hamiltonian allows me, so I haven't computed yet what these do to the fields. But these, if I've done the analysis correct and they all commute with each other, okay, then these generate free gauge transformations by the arguments I've made previously. Okay. But what I did is there's a simple observation that we haven't made yet, which is that I can get these from these by taking the divergence. In other words, if I take del script f equals 0, the first term goes away, because that's the Bianchi identity, and the second term is just this. Okay? So there are not these plus these. These are sufficient. Okay? Whew. Good. So there are 9 of these and 9 of these. So there are 18 initial value. There are 18 degrees of freedom of gauge transformation, 9 degrees of freedom of constraints, but the constraints generate gauge transformations which can be gauge fixed, giving me 9 gauge fixing conditions. So there are 18 conditions. So the conclusion is that there are no local degrees of freedom. And indeed, I can make that a little bit concrete. Let me ask, what if f generates gauge transformations, let me ask what delta of, say, A is by f. And I guess I should do, this will be my last calculation, but I guess I should do an honest calculation here, or at least sketch for you an honest calculation. So let me do the thing where I smear f against some function, and I'm going to call the function g. So I write the integral, and I'm going to, let me see how, what's the best way to do this. Let me take g a epsilon a b c f b c and do it that way. Okay, so that is the integral over the manifold of epsilon ABC FA, I'm sorry, G, and there are the Yang-Millet indices as well, times FBCI minus this term with lambda times GAI pi AI. So what's delta A? Delta A is the Poisson bracket of A, the vector potential at some point, x, with this generator. And if this acts the way that Dirac says first-class generators, first-class constraints do, it generates gauge transformation. This just picks up this term, proportional to pi. And the Poisson bracket between pi and a gives a delta, which goes away and gives g. So this is just minus lambda g a I of x. In other words,
there are 9 parameters per point of the gauge transformations here, G, A, I, and I can make the A vary proportional to free arbitrary functions. So in particular, I can make the A 0 everywhere. I can use this to make A prime, at least infinitesimally, which is A plus delta AI, and I can make this 0 by choosing G to be equal to 1 over lambda times A. I can make A prime 0. So I can use a gauge transformation to locally make all the A's 0. Okay? So that's an indication that there really are no local degrees of freedom. And you can similarly argue that you can fix the pi's to be anything you like. Okay. So what's the use of such a theory? Well, the use of such a theory is that we've had a first example of a diffeomorphism invariant theory. We're not done. We're going to continue next time because we haven't seen yet how the diffeomorphisms arise, but we're going to get to see that. Okay. But we have done a kind of overkill in which we studied a theory where there are no local degrees of freedom. Now, why did I say these things are useful for mathematics? Why they're useful for mathematics is that we were not careful about I integrated by parts a few times, and we weren't careful about that. There might have been boundaries, and there might also have been non-trivial topology, which would have had to be taken into account when I did the integration by parts. And when you are more careful, you discover that this is the counting per point, but depending on the topology of the four-manifold, there's a finite number of degrees of freedom left over. And the number of those degrees of freedom and their Poisson brackets depends on the topology. Therefore, when you do this completely carefully, you discover coded into the dynamical system you have left over is a representation of only the topology of the four-manifold, and exactly the topology of the four-manifold. Now, one question that we're going to want to discuss next time here is what are the observables? That is, what functions can we write down that are invariant under these transformations? And we'll discover that there are some observables that we can write down, and that they don't measure any local property of the fields, but they measure properties of the topology of the manifold. Okay, so that's why these are called topological field theories. Okay, let's stop here. Questions, comments? Yes.
So your constraint for closing is equivalent then to the gauge to the theory being invariant in the local under small gauge transformations.
Right. So there is also an issue of large gauge transformations.
Yeah, so how do large gauge transformations come in then?
Let's save that for next time. Okay. Large gauge let me agree with you, okay, the constraints generate infinitesimal gauge transformations. What that means is that if there is information in the global structure of the gauge group, for example, in the bundle, okay, of the connections over the manifold, then
that will remain physical information. So the gauge transformations do not include large gauge transformations not connected to the identity.
Those are, by Dirac's prescription, those are actually left as observable.
Very good.
Questions out there in Guelph and Western? London? Okay, well, I'm sorry to go home early. On the other hand, this has been a lot of stuff. So thank you very much, and see you next week. And again, please, people taking the class, please communicate with me.